WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That is, as always, the one that's right in front of you at all times, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. And that is what all of us want. Well, we have a really interesting show for you tonight. We've been doing this show for 13 years, and we have yet to dwell on this topic. It's one which you'll see, which you probably don't know already, is of really great importance to us and to our planet and to our ecosystem, and that I've heard very few people talking about. And that is the topic of sharks. That's right, sharks. Those amazing and most often feared animals that inhabit our oceans. Our guest on this evening's show, William McKeever, and he's at www.WilliamMcKeever.com, is the founder of Safeguard of the Seas, an NGO dedicated to ocean conservation and devoted to protecting sharks and the oceans threatened by humans. Through activism, advocacy, and education, their mission is to save sharks and the ocean. He's also the author of Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. Thanks for joining us on The Healthy Planet, William.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here.
So in your book, you talk about the fact that as a young person, you had an immense interest in sharks that caused you to read everything you could about them. Now, if that were today, you'd be spending your time doing internet searches on sharks. But back then, you went to the library and you say that you read everything that you could about them. Talk about your early fascination with sharks.
Well, I've always loved the ocean, and we always, as a family, would go to the beach in the summers, and I just loved being around the water, and I found sharks fascinating, so I would try to learn about them, and when I would go to the library, there weren't very many books about them, and the ones that were out there portrayed sharks as these very dangerous man-eaters. So it left me with an impression that sharks were to be feared. And I had that opinion of them, even though I always thought they were beautiful animals. And what was the tipping point for me was that I subsequently moved to Manhattan and got a job, of course. And during the summer, I would head out to Long Island, and in particular to Montauk. And one weekend, I stumbled on a shark tournament. And I don't know, Bob, if you're familiar with these, but this is where fishermen go out to catch the biggest shark. And what they do is gamble that they'll catch the biggest one, and I suppose for some that's fun, so-called fun. But what happens is that the sharks end up being thrown into landfills. And that made me so angry that I decided to do some investigating to find out about these tournaments and about sharks, and it started me on a journey that literally changed my life. And at the end of this journey, I have a book, as you mentioned, Emperors of the Deep, and also a documentary film about it. And the mission of both the film and the book is to take that view of sharks that I learned as a child, to update it to where we need to recognize these are wonderful animals, we need them for the health of the oceans, and they are not man-eaters. So it's a complete change of perception of sharks, and it's long overdue.
It is, and I will tell you, I've told you this already, doing research for this interview was one of the more interesting shows, I think, because it's a new topic for me, specifically looking at sharks. We've looked at oceans, we've looked at the various aspects of the oceans, climate change and all that, but we haven't done anything on sharks. And given their place in the ecosystem and everything that people will be learning during this show, I just will say again, I found it extremely interesting and enlightening.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic, and I think as you pull back the curtain on all this, you begin to realize just how crucial every ecosystem out there in the ocean. Sharks play a role. You know, there are over 500 species of them. They've been around for 450 million years, so they've worked their way into every niche, and they are incredibly important to the health of the oceans.
Now, you say that these magnificent creatures are truly evolutionary marvels that play an integral role in maintaining the health of the world's oceans and ultimately the fate of our planet. So let's first focus on the description of sharks as evolutionary marvels. Your book describes some really amazing attributes of various sharks that had me saying, wow, as I was reading them. Describe some of those, starting with their, well, you just mentioned their ancient origins, but put that on a relative basis compared to trees, and then go into the other aspects, like I remember the longevity of the Greenland shark, and the ability of sharks to dive to enormous depths, and their sixth sense, and the force of their jaws, et cetera, et cetera. I leave it to you.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think we have to roll back the clock 450 million years. And since that time, there have been five major extinction events. Some are saying we are in the sixth extinction event, given what's happening with global warming and climate change. And the sharks managed to survive. Now, of course, the sharks that were around 450 million years ago were totally unlike the sharks that we have today. And they evolved over time into over 500 species, as I said. And the sharks that are of the most interest today are the big sharks, the big four, the great white, the mako, the hammerhead, and the tiger shark. And each one of them is an evolutionary marvel. So I'll take the great white first. And we've learned so much about these sharks through tagging programs in the last several years. And they've tagged sharks to see where they go along the surface as well as how deep that they dive. Now, to put this in perspective, when the fish came along about 530 million years ago, obviously there was a major breakthrough when they developed the backbone. And humans are, of course, related to fish. We have a backbone. It came from our fish ancestors. And when the sharks came along, they diverged from the fish. So they got rid of the bones. They are completely made out of cartilage. They got rid of the swim bladders. And for buoyancy, they developed a way to have some buoyancy through the oil in their livers. And then they also were able to get rid of the scales, and they put denticles, which are these little plates that are on top of their skin. And that allows them to go incredibly fast through the ocean. In fact, the mako shark is one of the fastest sharks in the ocean, go 45 miles an hour. So just a tip of the iceberg of the changes that took place in the shark. And the modern sharks that we know today probably evolved around 200 million years ago into the ones that I mentioned. And as I was doing the research for the book, I found these incredible attributes. So as I mentioned, great white sharks, they have been known to dive to 3,000 feet, some go to 4,000 feet. To put that in perspective, a U.S. nuclear-powered submarine implodes at 1,700 feet. So they go twice as deep as a U.S. submarine.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah, and when you consider the pressure at that level, it's the equivalent of having one very large adult pig weighing some 400 pounds sitting on every square inch of your body. And their bodies are designed to take that pressure. And they can regularly go to those depths and come back up. And that, of course, now then the question is why they're doing that. And this is where we're still learning about sharks to understand. And the explanation now is probably that there is prey down at those levels, and in particular the giant squid, which if you think of the squid that we see on the surface at very deep levels at 2,000-3,000 feet, many of these animals become gigantic. It's known as gigantism. And so these squid can reach 60-65 feet. So it's likely that the great white sharks are hunting those squid. Again, that's just one attribute of the great white. As I go through some of the other sharks, the amazing thing is that they can navigate around the world's ocean. So tiger sharks, for example, have been known to spend their winters in the Bahamas, off of Florida. And then in the summertime, they'll migrate to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, some 2,000 miles away. And then,
like many Long Islanders.
Many Long Islanders. Sometimes tiger sharks will go by Long Island. And actually, just about every shark out there is off of the Long Island coast. You know, Montauk is blessed at being really the beginning of one of the most productive fishing grounds in the world, because you have that warm water coming up, mixing with the cold water, and you get a plethora of species and, of course, sharks. Virtually all the shark species, including the great whites, are right off of Long Island. So we're in an amazing place. Anyway, so the tiger sharks are out off of Long Island. And what they're doing is hunting all kinds of different animals. They are eating virtually anything. They have been found, things in their stomach have been found, like license plates, tires, garbage. They have found mammals. They've found fish. They're really out there cleaning up the oceans and keeping them clean. When there's a whale that dies, it's the shark that gets rid of them. And that's really important, because if the whales are there to their carcasses to rot, they spread disease, and they need to be some way to process those whales back to nature, and that's the job of the sharks. And that's just one function that they do. Interesting, on the tiger sharks, when they were looking at the contents of their stomach, they found bird feathers inside the stomachs. And of course, we all know the movie Sharknado, with sharks flying through the air. Of course, that's the typical utter nonsense that we have, like Jaws, about these animals. And what they found was that the juvenile tiger sharks, when they were in the Gulf of Mexico, they were planning their trip right when songbirds that live on the East Coast are migrating to Mexico. The reason being that when those songbirds leave the U.S. coast and go out over the waters, in the fall, they can run into inclement weather, and that can cause them to fall into the ocean. And the juvenile sharks use that as an opportunity to feed. And what's interesting is that event, the songbirds falling in the Gulf, occurs at a very tight window. And the sharks time their arrival exquisitely, so that they can be right there at the right time. If they're off by a few weeks, it doesn't happen. But they do this regularly, year after year, not just in the Gulf of Mexico, but off the Hawaiian Islands with albatross chicks and off of the frigate shoals. So they're traveling around the world. They're going to places, timing it perfectly. And just, again, remarkable that they are able to travel these great distances.
Yeah, that really is. With the last shark you mentioned, it's kind of like the dog knowing when dinner is on, and they go to the table and they wait for the handouts. The thing that also fascinated me was the way that they communicate, or what we don't know about their communications, and how they have a sixth sense.
Yeah, I think, again, going back to the original views about sharks was, well, they're solitary animals, they're really nothing more than eating machines. There's no interaction with other of their own kind. And now we're discovering that that's not true. And there have been a number of studies that have been done, one off of the Bahamas, where they studied lemon sharks. And they tagged them, observed them, and what they found was that the lemon sharks are actually social. And they hang out with their compatriots. They form friendships. They travel together. A perfect example is in these mangroves in the Bahamas where the lemon sharks live. If you're a young lemon shark, it can be dangerous when high tide arrives because the big predators like barracudas can come in, and they love to eat the lemon sharks, the young ones. Hmm. And so what the lemon sharks were doing was they were hiding at high tide, and they would go off together and pair off. And when the tide would go down again, they would come back out of their hiding places. But they formed these relationships, and they were not random. They lasted, the relationships, for years. And they also learned that the younger lemon sharks were observing the adult lemon sharks and learning from them how to hunt. Now, when I first read about this very, very, very good research by Dr. Tristan Guttridge, I thought, well, maybe this is a one-off. And as I did more research, I found that we're beginning to see this in other shark species around the world, specifically in Delaware Bay. And they tagged, again, the sharks. And in these tags, they can understand where the sharks are, where they're going. And what they found was that in the Delaware Bay, where they were going in the summertime, these sharks would actually stay with each other. And they would form these very large schools. And they would travel together and continue. And even when summer was over and they would leave the area, they would still stay in contact with each other. So here was another species. And then in my research for the book, Emperors of the Deep, I found out that hammerheads are social. They school together. And perhaps one of the most famous are the scalloped hammerheads off of Costa Rica, where they school literally in the hundreds, and they're massed together. And, you know, a lot of this is not mating. Sometimes it is, but they're getting together, and we're just, again, beginning to understand the rationale behind it. But it's clear they are a lot more social than humans ever gave them credit for.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. It seems that if you know one animal, it's kind of like you know them all, because they all have their personalities and their desire to be in a comfortable, enjoyable family situation, some more than others, depending on the type of animal they are. And I interviewed Jonathan Balcombe on this show a couple of years ago. He's a biologist with a PhD in the study of animal behavior. And he's written many books, one of which is called What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And he points out the sad fact that we've always assumed that fishes, as he calls them, have low intelligence, that people think they don't feel pain, that they don't have the ability to engage in complex social interactions, and more. But he says that these assumptions were not based upon any kind of factual investigation, and that studies now are telling us that these assumptions were entirely incorrect. And in fact, they were way off, with fish having some very good memories, working together with other species even, and doing things that we just would never have expected fish to do. And these, of course, today are inconvenient scientific revelations, given the fact that humans are responsible for killing trillions of these creatures every year. And it's not a pleasant or humane death by any means. So you say, forget dolphins, sharks are underrated. And that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I think to your point about intelligence, you know, fish are finally getting their due, and to put shark intelligence in perspective, they are one of the most intelligent fish in the oceans, far above. The brain of a great white is far more sophisticated than the brain of a salmon. They can literally run rings around them. And originally the view was that the brain of a great white shark was the size of a walnut. Well, they just didn't understand the structure of the great white brain. It actually branches off. You need to include these other aspects that give them their incredible sense of smell. They're also their incredible sense of navigation. So the brain is actually much larger, and the equivalent in a brain to body mass ratio, equivalent to marsupials. Now, I'm not going to say that sharks are going to be having a conversation about Proust anytime soon, but if they also have a way of navigating, have a way of interacting with their environment that shows great intelligence. As an example, when I was diving with sharks in Hawaii, we would go out in the boat, and we stopped, and we went over the side, and the sharks appeared. And I asked the captain, well, how did the sharks know we were there? And he said, oh, well, they figured out that when they hear the engines, that that's probably a boat that's got some fish. And what happens in the Hawaiian Islands, the fishing boats will throw their bycatch over the side, and the sharks get an easy meal. So the sharks think that we, the diving boat, are another fishing boat, so they came over to us. Again, that's just showing the intelligence of these animals. And they're also able to navigate these tremendous distances. So as an example, there was a great white shark that they tagged off of South Africa. And it went to Australia, but it did so in a straight line, went there, came back after just a few weeks there. It was a round-trip migration of some 1,200 miles in just a few months, and it was a straight line. Now, I know if I try to go from South Africa to Australia, I would get lost, let alone making it in a virtual straight line that they were able to show on a graph. So I think we're getting to the point where we can understand that these sharks have a great intelligence, great ability that we're just not appreciating. You know, I think when we look, for example, at dogs, we know dogs have a tremendous sense of smell. Sharks also have that amazing sense of smell, and people may be familiar with the fact that they can smell blood in the water. Now, perhaps it's an exaggeration. They can smell blood a mile away, but they can certainly smell prey that's within several hundreds of yards from them. And they can also use their electromagnetic senses to detect motions and detect commotions in the water that show where there are animals that are in distress, so they can take advantage of that. And they use this ability to sense electrical fields down to the point where when it comes time to attack their prey, they can literally, and I do this in the book, where a mako is going after a seal, they can literally track them, say, over half a mile, follow them, and deliver the coup de grace. They're amazing, remarkable hunters. And that great intelligence that they have allows them to do that.
That is amazing. You know, you mentioned in there that sharks will wait by fishing boats to catch the bycatch. And we've done a show on this, that bycatch is actually responsible. Bycatch is those fish, unintended species that are caught by fishermen. And it could include sea turtles, dolphins, whales, or sharks, seals, fish, other fish, birds. And what happens is when they're caught and they say, oh, we don't want those, they're thrown away. And estimates are that it's up to 40% of all the annual world's fish catch that is just thrown away right off the side of the boat. So sharks are also victims of that practice.
Well, yes, sadly they are, and that's a great point about bycatch and the waste that humans conduct around the world. One of the things that I've mentioned in the book is that there's a method of fishing called longline fishing, where a boat will go out and set one single line, and the length of these lines is staggering. Sometimes they're 100 miles long, most of them around 50 miles long, and they have baited hooks on these lines, and they'll set them, leave the line out overnight, and the next day pull everything up. Well, when you put a baited hook in the water, you're going to catch anything from seabirds to turtles, tuna, of course, which is what they're trying to catch, and sharks. Now, ordinarily, they should let the sharks go, but they don't. And the reason is that on these vessels, they want to catch the sharks and get the fins that they can sell to the Chinese for Chinese fin soup. And remarkably, still today in China, it is a badge of honor to have a dinner and serve shark fin soup. To them, it goes back to when the emperors used to do that over 1,000 years ago. And there are 70 million sharks that are killed every year for Chinese shark fin soup. And so we're killing them by bycatch. We're also killing them on purpose for frivolous reasons. The shark fin soup is actually tastes terrible. There's no flavor in it at all. They have to spice it up to make it palatable. And the devastation is just mind-boggling. And you know, it's something that could easily be stopped, and it ties into several other issues, which is in these foreign fleets that are catching tuna and catching these sharks, a lot of them use slaves, and it's a bit shocking, but it's something when you're on the high seas in the Pacific Ocean, there are very few eyes that are watching what's going on, and this is where poor men from Southeast Asia get trapped. They're shanghaied. They're put on these fishing vessels. They're out there for years. And the only money that they can make is when they fin the sharks and sell those fins, as I said, to the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So it's a crisis that involves the sharks and human beings that's very sad. And I'm so grateful, Bob, for being on the show to be able to talk about this, because this is something that we should all know. And when we have the knowledge about this, and we can put an end to it.
I agree with you 100%. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM. And we have with us as guest William McKeever, founder of Safeguard of the Seas and author of Emperors of the Deep. You mentioned we were talking about bycatch. Just to put a number on this, I mentioned 40% of the fish are potentially thrown overboard immediately after they're caught. Well, the total amount caught is somewhere around, and I might be off by a bit, but the estimates I've read from Oceana are 160 billion pounds per year. That's the total annual world fish catch. Of that, about 63 billion pounds are thrown away. 63 billion pounds. We're talking about trillions of fish over the course of a year that are being caught. And that's not the end of it. I think 37% are fed not to people, but are fed to pigs and chickens. So you end up with this world fish catch that is utterly destroying the oceans. And most of that is being wasted or not used to feed hungry people. So it is a big tragedy, and as you mentioned, it's a tragedy that's unnecessary, which makes it all the more painful or all the more hopeful that we can do something about this once we get a hold of the fact that it is a big problem that is our responsibility.
Yeah, that's a great point. You were talking about the use of some of this. Remarkably, when people have cat food or dog food and there's fish on the label, that's fish that is caught on these long line operations that use these questionable fishing practices. And it's something that I think, you know, when people buy these things, they should be aware that this waste is going on.
That's really good to know. You know, one of the things you start to understand, the more carefully you examine and even experience nature from your own eyes, ears, nose, is that all of Earth's creatures and the life support system itself are intricately connected. And this isn't just an esoteric spiritual belief, but an accurate portrayal of the dependence of all life and the impact of all life on the delicate ecosystem that we all share, our life support system. Now, I think in maybe the 1950s, that era at least, the attitude and before that time was that nature is inexhaustible. And as proof of our pioneering spirit, we're going to take what we want when we want it. And in fact, I see that attitude is reemerging now at a time when, of course, we can least afford to act in such a way. So from a human perspective, it's becoming more and more obvious that you can't have true health or true balance unless the ecosystem is healthy and the ecosystem is balanced. And again, that's not a spiritual belief either. We don't have to look any further than the fact that we're killing 4+ million people on our planet every single year with outdoor air pollution alone. That's pollution that we're putting into the air that at this point we have alternatives for. So there's no health in humans without health on the planet and with our ecosystem. And I know that you point to that interconnection when you state in your book that when we kill the sharks, humankind cripples the seas. And you also state that sharks play an integral role in maintaining the health of the world's oceans and ultimately the fate of our planet. So you've talked a little bit about that. Anything more to add about that balance that they create?
Yeah, there's a lot more to point out. And in my book, Emperors of the Deep, you know, I go through some examples. And I'll just give you a very simple one with seagrass. Now, seagrass is found around the world. What happens is that seagrass is actually very important to the ocean because it's a place where the little fish can hide and grow up, and it's a place where the sea can take the carbon out of the atmosphere, put it into that seagrass, and when the seagrass dies, it gets buried and sequestered. So it's crucial for several reasons. And the tiger sharks play an incredibly crucial role in protecting those seagrasses. And there was a study that was done in Australia in Shark Bay. And what they did was they looked at the turtles and the sea cows and dugongs that eat the seagrass, and they wanted to see what would happen if the tiger sharks were removed. And so they did some experiments, and they artificially set up some screens, et cetera. And what they found was that where there were tiger sharks around the seagrass, the sea turtles and the dugongs would not feel free enough to eat all the seagrass. They would nibble, and then they would take off. When there were no tiger sharks, they would just stick around and help themselves to an all-day buffet. And those areas, the seagrass was gone. But where the seagrass flourished was where there were plenty of tiger sharks. And so that was the lesson from that study in Shark Bay, that the tiger sharks protect those seagrass beds. And we need the seagrass, as I mentioned, for climate change, for habitat, for small fish that we need. And that's just one example. I also mentioned in the book about the importance of sharks and coral reefs. Coral reefs are some of the most diverse places on the planet and incredibly productive from a fish production standpoint. And what the sharks do on the coral reefs is that they prevent any one group of monopolizing resources. They keep all of the species in balance from the mid-level predators down to small fish. And again, when you remove the shark, you create what's called a trophic cascade. And a trophic cascade just simply says that a trophic, which means a level that is disrupted at one level, will then have effects on other levels and other species until you get this cascade effect that brings the whole system down. And in any ecosystem, when you take out the top or you take out the bottom, you cause the whole system to collapse. Now, you can take out the middle part of an ecosystem, and the ends will fill in where necessary, but you can't do that when you take out an apex predator like a shark on a reef. So, again, a specific example. In Australia, where they found sharks had been removed due to overfishing, they found that the reefs were literally crumbling. And the reason was, we got to step back and look at the different trophic levels. There are animals on the reef that clean the reef, get rid of the algae. Now, those are known as parrotfish. And for your listeners who are divers or snorkelers, those are the brightly colored fish that you see on reefs, and they're chipping away during the day on the algae. Well, when the sharks were gone, what happened was that the mid-level predators, like groupers, exploded in population and ate the parrotfish. And when the parrotfish were gone, there were no fish there to keep the reef clean. So the algae smothered the reef and killed it. And when the reef was dead and all of the coral pieces crumbled, there was no place left for the fish to hide. The whole system collapsed. So again, that's another example. And just even besides the parrotfish keeping the reef clean, the parrotfish, when they do their job, actually deposit, they take all this material in and they turn it into sand. And that sand helps to build up islands. So when you're on vacation and you're visiting a coral reef island, that sand is due to parrotfish, which is due to the sharks overseeing the system and providing that stability to the ecosystem. So I could go on and on and talk about this. Every ecosystem, from the poles to the equator, to from the shallows to the deep ocean, you need sharks. And if you take them out, you cause havoc. There's another issue, which is climate change and warming oceans.
Sure.
That's another issue, and that's creating havoc as we speak, which we're beginning to understand. But I think the key takeaway is that we've got to keep these ecosystems healthy by keeping the apex predators in place. And there's no greater example than this on land than in Yellowstone. When they took the wolves out of Yellowstone, there was a complete collapse of the ecosystem there, and they had to bring the wolves back, and Yellowstone is much better off now as a result, and you can thank the apex predators. So they're not the big scary killers that people think. They're the animals that bring life to the ecosystem, and we need them.
A very interesting distinction you make. There are two aspects to the almost unfathomable decimation of the Earth's shark population. And the first is recreational fishing, and the other is commercial fishing. Take these in turn and give us your take on how sharks are faring, both in the U.S. and the world.
Yeah, Bob, that's a good question. So let me start with recreational fishing, then we'll go to commercial fishing and kind of wrap up where we are with sharks.
Mm-hmm.
So first, with recreational fishing, what bothers me on the East Coast is that there people go out fishing for sharks, and I don't begrudge anybody fishing. I when I was a kid with my dad, we used to go fishing, and I loved it. But fishing for sharks is a bad idea, and the reason is because they're apex predators, and they play that crucial role in the ecosystem. So when you're taking them out for a tournament, you're doing real harm to the marine environment. And as an example, mako sharks, which are one of the top sharks, they are on the IUCN red list as an endangered shark, and they're under tremendous pressure of the population because they don't breed very often, maybe once a year. If they do, they only have four or five pups, and so they cannot withstand fishing pressures. So these tournaments just add another stress to these animals, and it's a terrible message to the world that we're supposed to be leaders, that we allow these shark tournaments to take place, that we allow damage to our own oceans, and that I step back to the idea of killing something for fun. You know, I have nothing wrong. Go catch fish that you're going to eat, bluefish, striped bass, have a great time, go for it. But not with a shark. That is utterly absurd. And so I've been working very hard on Long Island, and there are many people who have joined me in this. Carol Marcus has done some amazing things as trying to stop these shark tournaments.
Thank you, Carol.
And we need to put an end to it. And people need to get fired up and angry.
Yeah.
That this stuff is allowed. It takes place from Maine all the way down to Florida, and it's got to stop. So that's recreational fishing.
Yeah.
Number two is the commercial fishing, and I mentioned the longline fishing that takes place.
Yes.
In the Pacific, and it also takes place in the Atlantic Ocean, and this is where in total, the vast majority of damage to sharks takes place. And we need to put in place the kinds of rules and regulations that stops that kind of fishing. And let's go back to the fishing way it used to be in the 50s and 60s, which was fishermen would go out on a boat, they would have one rod with one line, and they would catch one fish at a time. And there would be no bycatch, and there would be no mistaking something that you didn't, or something that you wouldn't catch, something you didn't want, because you could be right there to throw it back, and you would get the tuna as well. And that's the kind of fishing that we should have. And I think that we as a society need to look at our treaties and our arrangements with entities around the world and say, you know what, we need to take a rational view, because at this rate, it's actually against our own interests to allow this kind of longline fishing to continue, because bluefin tuna are being stressed. And their populations cannot take this assault. And eventually, we're going to see these fish be overexploited, and then we're just not going to be able to find enough of them to put on our dinner plates. So anyway, getting back to the sharks, all these pressures, the commercial, result in 100 million sharks being killed every year. And the 100 million has been put together by very reputable scientific studies. Some shark species, like oceanic white tips, which are beautiful animals, going back to World War II, they were the most abundant shark in the ocean. And now their population is down 90%. Mm. They're very hard to even find due to this decimation. So they're not doing well. In their 450 million year history, sharks are facing one of the greatest threats they've ever faced.
Yeah, that's something.
It's a challenging environment for sharks.
Yep, to say the least. And you talk about the disproportionate threat that humans pose to sharks, which you've just mentioned, compared to the threat that sharks pose to humans. Talk about that disproportionate threat.
Yeah, so, you know, I go back to Jaws and, you know, that impression it left on people. I think about Jaws being shown on the movie screens at places like Martha's Vineyard. And the film should be banned. It's the biggest nonsense. Quint in real life was this Frank Mundus who fished out of Montauk. When he saw the movie, he actually laughed. He thought it was utterly ridiculous. And the whole notion of these sharks is searching for us is nonsense. Now, if you look at the statistics, and this is all in the International Shark Attack File, which is run out of the University of Florida out of Gainesville, there were four deaths in 2018 for the last full year. Four deaths versus 100 million deaths. So it's the sharks that should be afraid of humans and not the other way around. Now, if you look at just attacks, on average for the last several years, going back, say, 10, 15 years, in the United States, there's 50 to 55 attacks a year. And most of those attacks are, you know, involve a minor bite. And it's not being politically correct. It's just the fact. It's like being bitten by a dog on an ankle or an arm.
Right.
Not to say that there cannot be sometimes some damaging attacks, and I don't mean to minimize that, but still, in the scheme of things, if you look at the vast majority of attacks, the shark makes one bite, it's a mistake, they leave, and the person is, in this country, gets immediate medical care. So we very rarely have any fatalities in this country. In fact, the average is less than half a death per year. So again, this notion. Now, recently, in 2018, we saw a drop off in the number of attacks down to 32. So we're well below the average. 2019, they're putting the data together right now, but it looks like we're going to be below the five-year average again. So we're not seeing a huge jump in shark attacks. We may be seeing more sightings because we're now attuned to them and actually looking for them now. But the number of attacks last couple of years is actually down.
Isn't it interesting that you have very little chance of being attacked or killed by a shark in America? And yet, the fear of going in the water It's an ever-present fear to a lot of people. I'm not saying to everybody. And meanwhile, I could tell, you know, half a million to a million people how they could prevent a premature death from changing the way they eat. But they're not afraid of that. People aren't afraid of those things that are long-term threats that they're aware of, but they're just kind of like, it just happens, compared to the scary, unknown creature in the deep.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, there's so many other things that kill you. And in terms of other animals, sharks are at the bottom of the list. I'm sure your listeners are well aware of the number of people who are killed by bee stings. Who are killed by horses and ants cause allergic reactions. Four deaths is nothing, and it's again just we were deluded into thinking because of the media and movies like Jaws that they're man eaters. So you know you can go on YouTube and you can see in Miami, for instance, the tiger sharks. They come right up to the beach in that part of the country, and they're hunting. They got to make a living. And when they come across a human, they usually swim around them. And there are plenty of YouTube videos of a surfer falling off a board, and there's a shark right nearby. The shark does nothing. So it's quite something we've convinced ourselves of something that's just not true.
Yeah, fear is a funny thing. And it causes some pretty scary reactions. There is an Australian study. I'm sorry, were you saying something?
Yeah, I was just going to add about Australia. Glad you brought up Australia, because they did the first ever study of how do we predict where there might be a shark attack. And the purpose is, how do we protect ourselves? Which I can understand that families want to protect everyone, and that's a good goal. And so what Australia did was they looked at their 100-year history of shark attacks, and they came up with some conclusions. And number one is that they decided the best strategy when you go swimming is don't swim near river mouths. Stay away from the rivers. Why? Because rivers are places that bring a lot of nutrients into the ocean. There are lots of fish that hang around the river mouth. And with all those fish down there, that's going to bring in the sharks. And you're also encountering water that's very muddy and all that silt. It gets cloudy, so the sharks can't really see as well. They're kind of like staggering around in a dark room, so they can make a mistake. So that's one thing. Two is that you may want to be cautious when the water temperature drops. When I first saw this, I was scratching my head. Why would lower water temperature mean more shark attacks? And the reason is twofold. One is that you get currents that are warm, and when they get too warm and they start to move, the sharks don't like water temperature that's above their preferred range. So then they have to leave to go to cooler waters. And when they go into cooler waters, they go where the water has been pushed against the shoreline and the water has been pushed up near the beach. So the interaction then can take place with sharks and humans, because the humans are obviously on the beach. The sharks are in the colder water. They interact. And that, frankly, is really the number one driver for shark attacks. It's not that sharks are looking for us. It's that there are more people in the water. And when you have more people in the water, that means there's a possibility of a shark encounter and a mistake and a bite. And so colder water is a sign that there may be sharks in the area. And then lastly, I thought this was fascinating about rainfall. When it rains a lot, that can also precipitate a shark attack. The reasoning is, it's raining, the water gets into the river. Of course, it brings in all the silt and sediment. That goes in the river into the water. That extra nutrients attracts fish, and that attracts sharks. And again, that mixture of more sharks and people in the water means you have an increase in shark attack. So Australia has taken this study. It's available online. You can actually Google it. And they're going to develop an early warning system out of it. And probably something that we should probably think about. Now, in this country, we tried last year with the Cape Cod study to come up with something. And right now, it's elusive. It's very difficult to develop a system that's going to prevent shark attacks. I mean, it's just nature. Whenever you go out in any wilderness area, there are always risks, and there's always a chance for an encounter. But I think there are things that we can do. I think we can have spotters, and we can be cautious. And when there are sharks in an area, we can close the beach and reopen it. And there's nothing wrong with that. And so I think we can learn to live very easily with sharks without real inconvenience to us, and take actual pleasure in the knowledge that the sharks are out there, and that's a good sign. That means the ocean is healthy. And when there are lots of sharks, that's a good ecosystem, and that's good for us.
Well, that's a good twist on it as well. Thank you for that. You know, you were talking about fishing before and recreational fishing, and I remember that I had an early fishing experience. My father, like a good father, brought me out fishing, and we were catching, apparently, I think they were sea robins, I think they were called. And yeah. I may have that wrong, but I think that's what they were. And that wasn't the fish we were after. And so I saw them on the hooks. It was clear to me that they were suffering. And it left a really bad taste in my mouth from seeing the hooks in their mouths. And, you know, we talked about it. I talked probably with my sisters about it a little bit here and there. But I mostly forgot about it. And it wasn't until 15, 20 years later that I realized that that was not for me. And I stopped doing anything at all that would harm animals, including eating them. But that was a moment of my childhood where I first remember, and it had to do with fish, about looking at animals in a different way.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I had the exact same experience growing up. My dad loved to fish. He'd take me out there. We would catch sea robins, too. And he would throw them back.
Right.
But at the same time, there are other fish that he would catch, and he wouldn't throw back. And when you eat them, that's a legitimate use. But it's still, you know, I don't like to see cruelty to any animal. And when you bring an animal in, if you don't eat it, I think that's cruelty and unnecessary. And certainly with sharks, you can't eat blue sharks. The meat is tastes terrible. And these sharks, blue sharks, are caught in tournaments all the time. They're very easy to catch, by the way. Blue sharks are scavengers, so you put a baited hook in front of them, they're going to grab it. So it doesn't take any skill to catch a blue shark. And you don't eat it, and you throw it away, and I think, yeah, what's the point of all this? Is that really that much fun? I can't. I never think somebody could find something else
more
entertaining. You know, it's a world that there's enough cruelty that we don't need to add to it.
There is. And again, the part about it all being unnecessary is the part that really makes it unfathomable that we would continue in these practices when they are not necessary. And we have just a few minutes left, and I wanted to mention there was recently, just in May of 2019, there was an Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services that put out the most comprehensive report ever completed on the loss of biodiversity on the planet. Hundreds of experts from 50 countries, and what they concluded was that the destruction of nature is not just impacting nature, but basically it's threatening humans. And that hasn't really been said so much. And the punchline to this, and what relates to this conversation, is that the two largest drivers of this mass extinction that's taking place now, and it is indeed a mass extinction, on land is the livestock industry, and at sea, it's the fishing industry. So it's basically what we're choosing in terms of what we're eating that's causing this devastation of biodiversity. That is really hard to believe when you look at the numbers. And of course, that is impacting sharks as well. They are the victims of what's happening here. So with only this minute left, I'm going to ask you if you have any closing thoughts to leave with our audience.
Yeah, I do, Bob, and I think that hopefully we haven't depressed the listeners too much. But actually, I am an optimist, and I think these kinds of discussions that bring to light these issues are important, because then people can start behaving in a way that can help, and people don't realize what power they do have, because every time you go to the supermarket, every time you go to a restaurant, when you order fish, you send a very powerful message to the suppliers. And when you buy fish that are caught responsibly, in other words, they're caught in a way that's sustainable, so you can keep fishing for them indefinitely, and you buy that kind of fish, you're actually doing a service for the oceans. When you're buying, you're, again, sending a message to the suppliers, this is the way I want you to catch my tuna. And so you can help to change these behaviors out on the ocean by the purchases that you make. And so we should be optimistic that we can do this. We certainly can. It's because it's just a matter of will. And when we do, we're actually going to be better off ourselves.
All right. Thank you for all your wisdom, William. And thank you for all the work that you've done in putting together all this material. William McKeever, www.williammckeever.com. That's McKeever. And he's the author of Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. So I'm going to quote from your book to close this interview. You wrote, and I quote, "Sharks have never been considered beautiful creatures. Yet what all the sharks discussed in this book illustrate is that they are indeed beautiful and majestic emperors of the deep, every last one. Because beauty takes shape when one recognizes the diversity of life and comprehends nature's magnificent design, the experience of it touches the soul. Draped in various shapes and sizes lies a beauty to behold like pearls scattered throughout the world's oceans. We just have to open our eyes to see the sharks as if for the first time." Thank you, William McKeever, and good luck on your future endeavors.
Thank you very much, Bob, for having me on. And I would just say it. Christmas time, the book makes a great gift for really anyone. So
it's available on Amazon.
It's on Amazon and in bookstores.
All right, very good. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, and I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again on Friday, December 13th at this same time. That's 1 week from tonight at 6 p.m. Be sure to like our Facebook page by looking for Healthy Planet USA. You'll also get notified about the radio shows and all other kinds of events. I want to thank the 200 people who showed up to our Thanksgiving event 2 weeks ago. Amazing. It was our healthy, green, and turkey-free Thanksgiving dinner. It's a 26-year tradition, and thank you all for being there and taking part in that compassionate and thoughtful tradition. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives with great hosts sharing cutting-edge information. Until next time, stay strong, keep moving, relax. Think about what you're eating, especially when it has to do with animals. And keep speaking up in terms of what we need, in terms of where we're moving, both politically and on a social basis. If you see something, say something, talk about it. On that note, I thank you for being here, and I'll see you next week. Good night.
Out where the river broke, the bloodwood and the desert oak, holding wrecks and boiling.